To discuss the issue of persuasion. And I want to begin by saying that persuasion is actually quite difficult. And the reason that it's difficult is that individuals are highly opinionated creatures. Even people who say they don't have an opinion might firmly hold that they don't have an opinion and they don't want an opinion on a particular issue. It's not easy to persuade individuals to move them in a direction that you would like to move them. And in fact, for many kinds of public presentations and for debates, not only is an audience or a judge in opposition to the speaker, but they might be highly motivated to be in opposition to the speaker. They hear ideas with which they fundamentally disagree. They hear positions that are at odds with religious principles that they hold, or political ideals that they express, or cultural values that are at the foundation of their own identification. And so it is possible that not only will one have difficulty persuading an individual judge or an audience, but that it might be quite an act of resistance on the part of a judge or an audience to a presentation by an individual. But, of course, you still want to change their minds, move them in your direction, have them vote for you. It's necessary to appreciate the limits of persuasion, but then use techniques that might help you persuade an audience. Let me begin. Appreciate the limits. Appreciate the limits. As I said, individuals are opinionated. They have active brainwaves. They process information. They don't simply have information wash over them and change their ideas so that every single discussion that is held, they have a new set of opinions. Individuals resist the kinds of information that they receive, but at the same time, they also have information that is newly presented to them that gets them to move. And so it's necessary to identify that one might have an audience with individuals who strongly support the idea of the speaker, do not strongly support the idea of the speaker, but are open to change, do not strongly support the idea of the speaker, but might be closed to change, and strongly resist the ideas of the speaker. And so it's necessary to target a presentation that would appeal to the entire audience that has elements in it that would appeal to each of these audiences. That way you're reaching the entire audience. You're not excluding anyone from a presentation. You're trying to have inclusive presentations that will bring a judge or audience into the grasp of your voice. Now, how does one do this? First, one does it with substantive information. Arguments. Anticipate arguments. Anticipate the arguments from an opposing side in a debate. Those ideas might appeal to an audience or judge. Anticipate the ideas that are in the mind of the audience or the judge listening to a presentation. Just because an audience is silent doesn't mean it's not thinking. They might be supporting your idea, they might be rejecting your idea. It's necessary to anticipate those ideas in advance. Ask yourself how people with favorably inclined views and disfavorable views about your presentation, how they would react to it. And then design the speech, recontextualize it, redesign it, draft it again so that it would appeal to everyone who might listen to your presentation. Secondly, you need rhetorical appeal, powerful images, innovative ideas, effective use of language. It's surprising how the simple missteps that one might make. President George Bush referring to the strategic interests of the United States as strategery. How that kind of misstep can undermine the credibility of a speaker. And so one wants powerful rhetorical appeals to connect emotionally with an audience. It's also necessary to have an appealing style, friendly, cooperative, humorous, charming. That demonstrates a willingness to engage the audience, if it's acceptable given the nature of a format, to share information at a later time, to be available for questions and answers at the conclusion of the event. This demonstrates a cooperative nature that resists the kind of hostility that might be brought about by a demanding, insistent speaker. Finally, practice. Practice. Practice your speech for yourself, for small groups. Identify disagreement and pattern responses to those. And I think that kind of practice that involves the presentation of information in multiple contexts and the repetition of information for different audiences is an effective way to change the minds, or at least work to change the minds of audiences. Many audiences will agree, judges will agree with the presentation, some will not, you still need their support, and so it's necessary to practice in front of those audiences, receive feedback, listen to what they have to say, incorporate it in future presentations, and then adapt the presentations featuring substantive information, rhetorical appeals in an appealing style. This is the effective way of using persuasion in speech and debate events.
One of the first goals of the persuasion process is to influence the cognitive elements of your audience. Now, what do I mean by cognitive elements? Basically, I'm talking about ideas or concepts that people have in their minds that they use to construct their beliefs, their opinions, and their actions. Human behavior is basically based on motives and the cognitive elements which influence those motives. So you have to begin by changing people's minds. After you've changed their minds, then you can start working on behavior to get them to do things differently, but you have to start with that critical point of trying to influence cognitive elements. Now, for the purposes of understanding persuasion, we're going to take the ideas in your head, these cognitive elements, and turn them into several different types, and then talk about those different types of ideas and how you would try to change them and how they influence each other. The cognitive elements I'm going to talk about are attitudes, beliefs, values, and motives. Now, those are pretty common words, and they're not used in everyday speech in exactly the same way that I'm going to be using them. I'm going to be using them with some precision. So, for example, when you say, I have religious beliefs, or I have an opinion about football, then you're not necessarily using these words in the same context that persuasion scholars use them to try to understand different kind of cognitive elements. Persuasion is all about trying to get inside the head of those you're trying to persuade and then to use communication to affect what they've got inside their cognitive elements. So there are different strategies that work with different kinds of cognitive elements. So let's go through each of these and talk about what they mean, how we might define them, how they're characterized, and also how we might go about changing them, and we'll do that at the end. Let's start with a belief. A belief can be thought of as an affirmation that some concept has been perceived, accepted, and internalized. You believe that something is. A belief is your conception of reality, the way things are. I believe that I'm in a TV studio. I believe that London is in the United Kingdom. So a belief is your understanding of reality, the way things are. Your beliefs usually come to you from experience. You have an experience, you have knowledge, you accept some things unquestioningly as being true. You also receive your beliefs from other people. You may receive your beliefs about what's going on in another country through the newscast or through a book you read. But in any case, you establish a belief as something that for you indicates the way things are. Next, let's talk about a motive. A motive. A motive. A motive is a psychological state that you have. It's a self-perceived psychological state. It's something that you feel. You believe that something is non-rewarding in some fashion, and therefore you should do something to try to change that situation. Okay? So a motive is a self-perceived psychological state that something is not necessarily the way it ought to be, and therefore you would like to do something about it. So a motive indicates that we would like to change something. And motives are, of course, are key to behavior. People have to be motivated before they will actually do something. Your motives are created by your interpretation of all the complex things that are going on around you. Is this the way it should be? Do I like it? Do I not like it? Is there something that I could do about that? You create your motives moment by moment, day by day, as you go through your life. There are some motives that you have, perhaps to earn more money, or to increase your education, or curiosity, which may be ongoing, but our motives grow, become more intense, or are sated and become less intense based on our interpretation of what's going on around us. Next, let's talk about a value. A value. A value is your evaluation of the worth and or appropriateness of objects, events, or responses. Values are the world of ought and should. How should things be? Your values are basically standards that you create. Your standards for the way things ought to be. You have values about a job. Your job should involve these sorts of behaviors, these kinds of working conditions, a given pay level, a certain amount of hours. You have values. When you are searching for a job, you have a value about jobs, and you try to compare the jobs that are available to your standard for the way jobs ought to be. So values really are something that we have that tells us the way the world ought to be, the preferable, the standard, what we would like. Next, let's talk about attitude. Attitude. What is an attitude and where does it come from? Well, an attitude is really the verdict you place on objects, events, situations, people. It's your evaluation of whether you like things. It generally is a positive or negative judgment, your attitude. I like London. I do not like licorice candy. I like soccer. I do not like synchronized swimming. You have different kinds of attitudes. Generally, these are positive or negative. That doesn't mean that they're just one way, either yes or no. You have strengths of attitudes. You really, really, really like certain kinds of ice cream, and you really, really dislike specific kinds of licorice candies. So you can have strength of your attitude. So your attitude is your evaluation of the way things are, you know, and whether you like that. Now your attitude is constructed through the interrelationship of a couple of the other cognitive elements. Two other cognitive elements are very important for the structure of an attitude. First, your belief, the way things are. Right? If you like the way things are, you have a positive attitude about it. And if you don't like the way things are, you have a negative attitude about it. Also, values play a very important role in shaping attitudes. Remember, a value is what things ought to be. If things are as they ought to be, then you have a pretty positive attitude about it. If things are not how they ought to be, you have a very negative evaluation about it. So your attitudes are created by cross-referencing in your mind your beliefs about something with your values about something. If the way things are pretty well matched up with the way things ought to be, you have a positive attitude about it. If the way things are not the way they ought to be, if the way things are worse than they ought to be, then you tend to have a negative attitude about those sorts of things. So we have beliefs, and they tell us the way things are. We have values that tell us the way things ought to be. We have attitudes, which describe our basic verdict on things. Do we like them or dislike them? And the more they're like the way they ought to be, the more we like them. And the more they're not like the way they ought to be, the more we don't like them. And finally, we have motives. To the extent that everything is wonderful, that we have positive attitudes about things, that really things are the way they should be, we're not very motivated to change them. But to the extent that we have negative attitudes, where there is a serious gap between the way things are and the way things ought to be, when we have that self-perceived psychological state, which we interpreted as being unrewarding in some fashion, and we think that we could do something that would resolve that self-perceived psychological state of something being non-rewarding, then we are motivated to do something. I want to give a very simple example, and one that many people might be able to relate to, and that's to think about how much money you make on your job. How much money you think you make on your job. Let's say that you're employed and you have a job and you're receiving 2,000 pounds sterling a month. You're getting 2,000 pounds sterling a month. That is your belief. I believe that my payroll level is 2,000 pounds a month. Well, how do the other cognitive elements affect that to determine how you really feel about your job? If for example, your value of what do I think that I should earn for my job is 1,500 pounds a month, then you're very satisfied with the way things are. You believe that, you know, I'm only really worth about 1,500 pounds a month. I'm getting 2,000 pounds a month. It's pretty good. If, on the other hand, you believe that because of your charm, your considerable expertise, and your skills in the workplace, that you deserve 3,000 pounds a month, then, of course, you would be very dissatisfied with the fact that you're only receiving 2,000 pounds a month. If you thought you were worth 1,500 and you were getting 2,000, your attitude would be positive. If you're getting 2,000 but you really deserve 3, then your attitude is likely to be negative about how much money you're being paid at work. And in fact, if you felt very negative about it, you may decide that you were motivated to do something about it. I need to find another job that pays me what I'm worth. I need to talk about getting a raise in pay and make arguments in favor of that. We see how all of these elements reflect one another. Let's continue with this job example to talk about one of the most important factors in persuasion and the way you manipulate some of these cognitive elements by talking about a disparity relationship. A disparity relationship. Now, we already saw when there's a difference between how much you're being paid and how much you ought to be paid, you perceive a disparity. One of the things that we can do that's very effective for persuasion is either try to widen the disparity between what ought to be and what is, or narrow the disparity between what ought to be and what is. And you can use that through communication in the persuasion process. Let's talk for a moment about how to change some of these different cognitive elements and how we might try to influence them, some of the basic tactics. Now, I would say that if you're interested in studying this, there's a very rich literature. There's a number of citations and references that you'll find at the website that accompanies this particular lecture series, and I would encourage you to look at them to get more detail on some of the techniques that I'm about to mention. But I think that these can be incredibly useful in a practical way when you're trying to figure out how can I persuade someone to change a particular cognitive element. I think it's essential for you to decide what your target is. One of my graduate advisors, Kim Giffen, used to say, if you aim at nothing, you will surely hit it. And I think his point is that you have to have a goal and you have to have an object. That's extremely important when you're talking about persuasive communication. What is it that you're trying to influence? Am I trying to change a belief, the notion of the way things are? Am I trying to change a value? Am I trying to influence the way things people, the way people think things ought to be? Am I trying to change an attitude, people's evaluation of and verdict, positive or negative, about certain situations or things? Or am I trying to motivate people? Am I trying to convince them that there is this non-rewarding state that they need to do something about? Sometimes you need to influence several of them, and sometimes you influence some of these elements by targeting others. Let's just use some very basic examples. If you're trying to change a belief that someone has, one of the best ways to do it is by introducing new information. A belief, after all, is the way we think things are. We don't really know everything about the way things are. We can get new information. Now, in the 21st century, we're quite used to getting new information, finding out new things. Our beliefs change fairly rapidly as we get new information and new ideas. So if you want to change beliefs, you can start by giving new information. You can also try to indicate new relationships between beliefs that they currently have. You can change some beliefs by using beliefs that they already accept, showing relationships between them, how they influence one another, take beliefs that they have, and use those to try to influence new beliefs or change other beliefs that they have. Let's talk about values next. How do you try to persuade someone to change their values? Well, values, we can think of them as being very difficult to change because they tend to be inculcated in us at an early age, or they could be fairly easy to change because they're only abstract things. With a belief, you have to show concrete evidence, this is how it is. New information shows this is the way the world is. But with a value, it's a little easier because it's more abstract. So some values are easy to change because they're abstract, and they do it inside, no one needs to tell anyone that their values have changed. But on the other hand, some values tend to be inculcated early in life, so they can be somewhat challenging. Either way, here's some advice for trying to influence and change people's values. Probably the most common method that's been used in modern times is known as consciousness raising. You tell people that things could be so much better. You point out that our expectations are too low. You try to raise people's expectations. Consciousness raising has been a very important factor in the empowerment of social groups that have previously been marginalized. Women, for example, to the extent that they have values that say, yes, I am just going to be a housewife. Yes, the wife is subordinate to the husband. No, I cannot have a career. They are establishing their values, and they can establish them at a fairly low level. Consciousness raising is where you introduce the possibility that so much more is possible. For example, women began to believe that they could be equal, and in some cases, on a negotiated basis, dominant partners in a relationship, that they could have a career outside of the home, that they could earn just as much money, if not more, than men, that high levels of educational achievement were realistic for them. So consciousness raising is a process through which you can change people's values by showing them that it could be much better, that they need to raise their expectations. They need to lift their sights. Now, when you do that, usually you need to indicate that it is possible, it is realistic, you can show examples that it's happened, but I would urge you to consider consciousness raising as a way to change values. One of the other ways that you can try to influence values is by pointing out new relationships that exist between existing values. You can take a value that they're applying to something else and apply it to a specific situation at hand. Many people would have a value that slavery is not appropriate, that we should not have slavery. Interesting, just the other day, I was reading some of the critics of the 21st century norm of work who were saying that work is very much part-time slavery. You have a boss, your boss tells you what to do, you do whatever you're told, you may be able to quit, but you have to find some other job, and in any case, for a part of your life each week, someone else is in charge of your life, not you. I think that was a pretty good example of someone trying to take a value from something else, slavery, and apply it in a brand new way. You can take a value that your audience already has and apply it to something new to try to raise their values or influence their values in that regard. Let's talk about attitudes next. Attitudes, as we mentioned, are positive or negative evaluations of things. I like baseball. I don't like my job. I like knockwurst. Well, I think there's a couple of ways that you can try to change attitudes. If you would like to switch attitudes from being negative to being more positive or less negative, then I think what you want to try to do is to narrow the disparity relationship. Let's take our example of our job. We're being paid 2,000 British pounds sterling a month to do our job. Now, to the extent that we believe that we deserve 3,000 pounds a month, then we have a negative attitude. We're not being paid really what we deserve. We have a negative attitude. You can try to influence that by narrowing the disparity relationship. You could suggest, for example, that there are other things that are wonderful about your job that are not necessarily figured into that 2,000 pounds sterling. For example, you could have many insurance benefits, other benefits, paid holidays, education benefits, things that are not figured in. You make it look better than it is. Or you also might try to lower expectations. Well, you are really not worth 3,000 pounds sterling a month. You are not internet savvy. You cannot run a bunch of software. You are not capable of doing statistical manipulations and analyses. So you try to narrow the disparity relationship by pointing out that your belief, things are better than you think they are, or by saying that your expectations are too high, they're unrealistic, they need to be lowered. So you can reduce negative attitudes by narrowing the disparity relationship. Now, if you would like to increase negative attitudes, perhaps you're trying to gain a negative attitude so it will create some kind of motive for behavior, you might want to widen the disparity relationship. If I'm trying to make you feel negative about your job, I will say, well, you know, you really are worth more than 3,000 pounds a month because you are so handsome and so beautiful and a fashion plate as well, such an addition to the business environment. You must be worth at least 3,300 pounds sterling a month. So as you widen the disparity relationship, people become less satisfied. Or I would try to say that, you know, that 2,000 pounds a month that you're getting, your belief of the way things are, is really limited because you have to pay for parking, you have to pay for the coffee fund, you have a long commute, right? You're reducing the perception of the way things are so that it widens that disparity relationship. So disparity relationship is the key to changing attitudes. You can widen it, make people feel less satisfied, negative attitude, or narrow it or expand it in the other way to reduce a negative attitude or increase a positive attitude. Finally, of the elements, let's talk about motives. Let's talk about motives. I think that the key to creating motivated behavior is to create disparity relationships. To create disparity relationships. Because the more the negative attitude is created, and remember a motive is a self-perceived psychological state, which is interpreted as being non-rewarding in some fashion, and so then people want to do something about it. To the extent that you increase that disparity relationship between the way things are and the way things ought to be, to the extent that you create negative attitudes, you are well on the way to creating motives. One of the other things you can do is to highlight specific needs that people may not be aware of or may not be currently conscious of. People may not be aware that given ideas, let's say given government policies, can affect them personally. Personal involvement is a very important way to create motivated behavior. People may say, oh, I'm not opposed to the Trade Reform Act because I think that we need more trade with other countries, but you could really change that motive and get them motivated against it by pointing out that that specific trade act would threaten their industry, their company, their job. When you create personal involvement and highlight specific needs that people have, it's another way to try to increase motivated behavior. So, we see that there are beliefs, attitudes, values, motives, that they relate to one another, that there are specific ways in which you can try to influence them. In closing, though, I just want to mention some of the organizational characteristics that are involved in people's cognitive elements. Everyone has cognitive elements, ideas inside of them. I would imagine that we all have the ones that I've mentioned in this list, but they may be put together differently, and I want to talk about four organizational characteristics for cognitive elements that you might want to be aware of, because how people put their cognitive elements together has a lot to do with how you go about through communication in the persuasion process trying to influence them. You should think about different levels of cognitive organization on the part of your audience or whoever it is you're trying to persuade. First, in terms of complexity. Do they have lots of ideas? Are they cognitively complex or cognitively simple or in the middle? If they are cognitively complex, then you can use different elements. If they are cognitively simple, you may need to create different cognitive elements before you start manipulating them. Second, are the cognitive elements in a hierarchy? Are some ideas more important than others? Try to identify which ideas, which attitudes, beliefs, values, and motives are most important for your audience and try to deal with those. If other cognitive elements that you need to manipulate are not thought of as important, then you need to try to raise them in the hierarchy. These are more important. Sports are incredibly important to some people and not important to others because they are on different spots on the hierarchy. As well, some people tend to have very hierarchical cognitive structures. There are a few central ideas and everything else is arrayed below that. Other people have a more equal status between different cognitive elements. Third, compartmentalization. Some people have different groups of cognitive elements compartmentalized so they don't influence each other. One example would be, you might have a compartment for your cognitive elements about business and a separate compartment for your cognitive elements about religion, that you don't cross-reference between religion and business. Religion is something that happens on a specific day, and it's a specific sort of ritualized belief whereas business is completely different. You may, for example, as some people do, espouse moral standards in your religious compartment that you don't necessarily carry out in your business compartment. And if ideas and cognitive elements are compartmentalized, it's very difficult to use some cognitive elements from a different compartment to influence other compartments and their cognitive elements. Finally, there's the nature of consistency. Is it important to you that your cognitive elements be consistent? Sometimes this trades off with compartmentalization. To the extent that they're compartmentalized, they don't have to be consistent. We're not worried that our religious beliefs aren't reflected in our business behavior. But if you have high consistency needs, then you're concerned about contradictions, about conflicts between values, attitudes, and beliefs. And you can use inconsistency in someone who does want consistency as a way to try to influence them. So what we've seen is that when we're trying to persuade people, we need to focus on their cognitive elements. We're trying to change their minds, that there are different kinds of cognitive elements, that they relate to each other in meaningful ways, that there are different ways to try to influence these cognitive elements, and the cognitive elements are structured in ways that are important to our persuasion attempts. One thing is clear, though, after we affect their minds, we may want to persuade their behaviors, which is what's coming up next in this presentation.
I've been asked to speak to you about persuasion theory and how it applies to behavioral change. And so I'll make some observations and hopefully provide you with some usable information. First, we often persuade to affect behavior. The purpose of a persuasive act of sorts is to challenge either opinions or attitudes, and from that challenge maybe produce some behavior. So we challenge behavior, and we do that by challenging the attitudes and opinions that the audience has. Presumably, if we can in any way impact the opinions and attitudes of the audience, we may, as a result, also be able to affect their behaviors as well. Most of the theories associated with persuasion and behavioral change can best be traced back to Gary Cronkite and a text he wrote entitled Persuasion that's been around for many years, but is still quite useful. Let me talk to you about some of the theories. I think I'll just talk to you about three today. There's a lot of possibilities here. I'll just talk to you about the ones that I think are cleanest and the ones that I try to use in the classroom. The first theory is a theory of cognitive dissonance. It's called Cognitive Dissonance. It was a book title written in 1957 by Leon Festinger. And its theory is pretty basic, but it has profound significance. He argues that a person who makes an irrevocable choice will search out evidence that she made the correct choice. In other words, when we do make a decision, we want to receive positive reinforcement that the decision we made is correct. And so he makes this observation. And he gives you an illustration of a person who buys a new automobile and then finds many advertisements and articles about that automobile that says that it's a good choice. And we normally engage in this as an ego and esteem defense mechanism. And this is one of the theoretical conclusions that Festinger makes in his book on a theory of cognitive dissonance. On another level, he talks about how if there are discrepant cognitions creating tension, then the individual strives to reduce them by making cognitions more consistent. Let me give you a good, clear example of this. If, for example, we discover that we don't like a certain person for whatever reason, but we then find out the person is a church-going person and we tend to like church-going persons, we'll try to make our cognition of the person more amenable because he falls within that category of church-going people. What this leads Festinger to conclude is that audiences will embrace dissonance-reducing behavior. What we try to do is try to reduce the dissonance that appears in our lives. We don't want a high level of uncertainty. We don't want challenges to our ego and challenges to our esteem. So what persuaders have discovered is that we can be quite effective in affecting opinions and attitudes and often behavior if we can create enough dissonance in our audience. If we can provide our audience with information which may challenge their ego and their esteem and compel them to reduce that dissonance, and that dissonance might be reducible by changing their behavior. That theory is Leon Festinger's cognitive dissonance theory. Another theory I often teach in the classroom has to do with a theory called the judgmental approach. It's from about 1957. It was designed by O.J. Hovland and Muzaffar Sharif. And it has a basic premise to it. They argue an individual has a range of attitude positions around his or her own attitudes called a region of acceptance and a region of rejectance. That having been said, what does this mean? Let's take the value of patriotism. In other words, if I believe that patriotism is a high positive value, there will be a series or there will be a world of ideas. They might be opinions, they might be attitudes about patriotism, which will be within my range of acceptance. I may believe that I have a patriotic duty to fight for my country if my country is attacked, right? That would be within my range. Now, there might also be a region of rejectance, and that is the region outside of the region of acceptance. I might believe I have a patriotic duty to fight for my country, but I do not have that duty when my country is not being directly challenged. And we saw this region of acceptance, region of rejection being dealt with regards to United States foreign policy during the Clinton administration, when questions arose as whether the United States had any real reason to be involved in the internal affairs of some countries. For example, there was a grand debate over whether the United States should have gone into Somalia or not, and definitely a debate about whether the United States should spearhead NATO forces in Kosovo and in the Bosnian conflict. And the reason there was such a high level of tension and conflict was because it was outside of the normal range of acceptance when Americans have been asked to sacrifice for their country. We've been asked to sacrifice for our country when our allies were challenged directly, as in during World War II, or when we were under direct attack, which occurred, of course, in the Pearl Harbor incidents in World War II. But in the New World, it was rather problematic when we saw conflicts occurring in geographically dispersed areas where we did not see a real, tangible, personally verifiable interest. We have two options then as a persuader. The first option is you stay within the range. If you stay within the range of acceptance, you'll be quite effective as a persuader. Now, once you leave the range of acceptance, then there's an incredible challenge. But in order to adjust for that, we discovered that in persuasion, the first step you need to do is adjust the range. In other words, before I can convince people that they need to be patriotic and fight for their country in a Bosnian conflict, I might have to find a way of redefining what patriotism is so the Bosnian conflict is no longer in the region of rejectance, but instead within the region of acceptance. So persuaders have discovered that that requires a two-prong approach to persuasion. The first is to change the region of acceptance to include the phenomenon being debated and discussed. Then the next step is to make the argument. If we do that, we find out we can affect opinions and attitudes, and in some instances, actually impact behavior as well. The third theory I want to mention is drawn from a relatively unknown book in 1987 called The Anatomy of Illusion by Kaiser and Kaiser, and it was written to address the issue of cults because they were on the rise on the 80s. It borrows quite heavily from a 1961 book by Edgar Schein called Coercive Persuasion. And coercive persuasion involves three steps. The first step is something called unfreezing. And according to Schein and Kaiser and Kaiser, we need to produce some unstable psychological condition. And you can do this in a lot of ways. Physically, you can do this quite simply by changing someone's physical location, so you're really challenging them. Also, you can remove them from valued relationships. Now, this is a normal process in military service. In other words, when you join the military or are inducted into the military, what happens is they change your physical location, they change your relationship to your valued relationships by physically removing you from your friends and relatives, and that puts you in an unstable psychological condition. That having been done, they are much more able to change how you feel about things and how you behave. Another way of unfreezing and producing an unstable psychological condition is to adopt radical ideas, because when you start embracing radical ideas, they are usually in conflict with the ideas you have upheld for maybe many decades. That type of tension produces an unstable psychological condition, and that can produce some level of unfreezing. The second step, according to Shine and Kaiser and Kaiser, is changing. And it's a series of acts that you can engage in where you seek to reduce inner ambiguity that occurs and the lack of direction that you may have. And the way you do this is by adopting new values and alternative worldviews. This is the core of how penology works with incarceration and rehabilitation. In other words, you never get to the step of rehabilitation unless you can break the prisoner with incarceration. Once you unfreeze them with incarceration, you then can reduce the inner ambiguity and lack of direction by choosing rehabilitation as an option. And often the rehabilitation can take many forms, ranging from educational programs all the way through Bible studies, etc. The third step in coercive persuasion is the step of refreezing. And refreezing refers to the consolidation of an alternative ideology so that the newly acquired frame of reference will not vanish and will not change. And the way you do that is with a change of circumstances and environments. And most often found way to change this is through group support programs. Outpatient psychiatric services work this way, where once the patient has gone through some sort of a therapeutic regimen, what would then happen is outpatient meetings, often within a group. And what you use the outpatient services to do is to reinforce the changed behavior. Alcoholics Anonymous works this way, as well as a lot of group structures. Juice Mercado in 1956 used the term menticide to describe how, through the process of unfreezing, changing, and refreezing, we can completely change opinions and attitudes, and in many cases, change behavior as well. In terms of how it works for the persuader, I mean, as a person trying to brainwash another, this methodology has been used with great regularity. As a persuader, it tells you that if you want to be sufficiently coercive to change behavior, you need to produce an adoption of radical ideas. Then what you need to do is try to establish some effort to reduce their ambiguity and lack of direction by giving them a way out of these conflict between radical ideas and the ideas they believe in, and you need to consolidate it. And so as a persuasive strategy, it can involve using epiphany, new ideas, radically new research, producing a level of conflict, then explaining a way out of the level of conflict by choosing a change in behavior. The last thing I want to mention before I get to the implications of this is to talk about destructive persuasion. There's destructive persuasion has been addressed in a lot of different settings and normally involves two strategies. One is the manipulation of need. In other words, if you want to persuade someone to behave in a different way, you can use the manipulation of need to do this. The three most predominant ones we find in the literature is the lure of sex, using sex as a way to manipulate individuals and manipulate need. It's used as recruitment tools in cults, and it's used as a highly effective advertising tool in persuasion. The second way you manipulate needs is to overcome resistance by appealing to emotions. Emotive reasoning is not a reasoning which is easily decodable into formal rules that we normally associated with things like deduction and induction. Emotive reasoning has its own rules, and those rules, when appealed to, can be incredibly powerful. You can use fear appeals and get people to change their behavior by inducing a high level of fear. Also, you can use appeal to self-esteem. We try to reduce the amount of conflict in our lives on so many different levels. And when we feel our self-esteem is being challenged, we will do the best we can to try to resolve whatever challenge exists there. The other way we can engage in destructive persuasion is through information control. We can control information. And there's a lot of ways to do that. One is called ideological restructuring. And ideological restructuring occurs very often in conspiracy theories. And it's often used by cults where you produce enemy constructions which are at odds with whatever reality the subject of the persuasion is currently nested within. You can also appeal to emotions and authority. I.A. Richards talks about this when he talks about God and devil terms and how powerful they can be used to short-circuit the normal reasoning process. What are the implications of all of this? Well, I think there are implications on at least four levels. First level, arguments producing a sufficient level of cognitive dissonance will encourage cognitive restructuring. And if that's true, then if you can produce cognitive dissonance, it will lead to restructuring, and that can impact behavior. That's the first implication. And the second implication is arguments beyond the region of acceptance demand range adjustment as a precursor. So if I want to change a behavior and I'm asking them to change behavior outside of their acceptance range, I need to adjust the range first before I ask them to change behavior with my arguments. That's the second implication. A third implication is arguments radical in nature may demand a more coercive strategy involving a high level of inner ambiguity and lack of direction. And so when we want to truthfully change someone's behavior and it needs to be changed radically, we need to produce a high level of inner ambiguity. We need to challenge a lot of beliefs that they hold true in order to impact their behavior. Finally, and the fourth implication is arguments that demand irrational responses must tap emotive reasoning. Emotive reasoning is a way to actually short-circuit a lot of the rational tools we use in persuasion and can be highly effective and have been associated with things like destructive persuasion involving the manipulation of need and informational control. For more information on persuasion and behavioral, you can turn to Gary Cronkite's text on persuasion. You might want to study the theories of Leon Festinger on cognitive dissonance, or Harvey Hovland and Musaver Sharif's on judgment, or even Kaiser and Kaiser on the anatomy of illusion, and Edgar Schein's coercive persuasion, and Juice Mercado's menicide to have a sense of how behavior can actually be impacted by persuasive messages. And finally, you might want to examine destructive persuasion in terms of manipulation of need and information control to actually change behavior significantly in an audience. Thank you.